This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the tragedy at Virginia Tech a year ago when a young man named Sung Hui Cho killed 32 students and faculty members and then himself, colleges across the country have reconsidered the issues around the mental health of students. Mass killings are very rare, of course, but many schools decided to change policies that emphasized the privacy of students, who are almost all over the age of 18, and focus instead on identification and treatment for young men and women who might be a danger to themselves and others. Cornell University started such a program well before Virginia Tech. Faculty, counselors, psychologists, administrators, RAs, campus police, even janitors share information about potentially troubled students, and while it's impossible to tell whether that's prevented mass murder, the number of students who commit suicide is down. Students, professors, counselors, and administrators, how does your school address mental health on campus? What works and what doesn't? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can also tell us your story on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, movie maker Morgan Spurlock's search for Osama bin Laden. But first, mental health on college campuses, and we begin with Tristan Davies. He teaches writing at the Writings Seminars at Johns Hopkins University and joins us now from the studios of our member station in Baltimore, WYPR, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil.
And I understand just yesterday you confronted a student about her writing.
It was. It happened just that recently. A young woman had written a story about an exchange student in Tokyo who was on a commuter train in the morning into town that struck a woman who had stepped in front of it to commit suicide at a place that's very well known. In fact, it exists where people do this. And it started in the story. It started this complex thinking on the part of the character about his own isolation in Tokyo and his lack of human connection, which then triggered some, frankly, delusional behavior. And finally, a scene where he looks out over an empty courtyard with a sort of cement floor and far below the room in which he's staying in the suburban dormitory. And I asked her if she'd come. You know, I mean, it was concerning. I asked her if she'd come see me, and she did. And she said, I asked her how things were going, and she said, first of all, he wasn't trying to kill himself, and second of all, everything is fine. Hmm. And frankly, in that case, I was fairly confident that things were okay with her. I know her well. She's a smart and really talented young woman. But I asked just the same.
And better to ask than not to ask, I guess.
In every instance. Yeah, I think that any time that someone... Fiction is something that didn't happen, not something that isn't true. And any time someone writes, you see in a person's writing violence, hatefulness, scenes of self-destruction, I think it's incumbent upon you to address it.
On the other hand, of course, just because somebody writes about someone who's depressed, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're depressed themselves.
Sure. The overwhelming majority of the time, it is purely creative. But it is still, fiction is generated by counterfactual conditionals, which means it could happen. And for the student to write it, the students thought it. And generally speaking, most of the time, and quite happily, it is benign.
And yesterday, you were convinced that it was benign. There have been examples in the past, though, you've taught in this program for 15 years, where it's not been benign.
Sure. And it was one of the more disturbing things that's ever happened to me. I ended up walking a woman to meet the car that took her directly to the hospital. It was painful.
What were the red flags in that case?
In that case, I think it was one of those situations where the red flag was, the stress. I think all of these, particularly this time of year, I was thinking as we were waiting to go on, this is an extraordinarily difficult time of year in the academic calendar. School is winding down. It's the end of the full year as opposed to the semester. It's a beautiful day like it is today in Baltimore. And there are just a lot of conflicting thoughts that come to mind. And in this instance, the sort of terrible one that I had, it was just merely a question of a schedule for class the next semester that conflicted with something else. But very quickly I could tell that it was just the pretense for her being upset.
And do you do this as a result of some policy at Johns Hopkins University, that there's a guideline somewhere saying if you're concerned, you should talk to the student?
Well, Hopkins is extraordinarily careful. They have a very, very good undergraduate advising program and counseling center, and I think they're very, very thoughtful about it, and have been for a long time. But I think it's a part and parcel of what I do. I see a very personal side of my students, and I think to be able to respond to it, you have to be tuned in, and most of the time it's happy because we're talking about creative, sort of thoughtful things, but there is some darkness, and you have to be sympathetic to it.
Sure. But would more information help? I mean, if, for example, one of your students was writing something that disturbed you or raised questions for you in any case, and if the campus police knew that this person had been arrested for binge drinking 2 days ago or something like that, would this information, would some coordination here be useful?
Sure. Yeah, there's never exactly. There isn't too little information. I mean, there is such a thing as too little information. I would always like to know as much as I can. In my racket, I end up knowing a lot without hearing about their binge drinking, or I hear about their binge drinking without hearing it from the police department.
Sure. You've been doing this for 15 years. Was there a first time when this that red flag first popped in your head?
Well, I think that's the thing that I find sad about some of the stories that I've heard, is that it seems to me that people aren't getting the attention that they need, not because they're in distress, but because they're just not getting the attention that they need. They're not in an environment where there's people who are paying close attention to what they do week in and week out. And that strikes me as the shame, not just for the person in danger psychologically, but for the happy and thriving student as well. I see them enough that I get to know a little bit of what's going on in their lives.
We're talking with Tristan Davies, who teaches creative writing at Johns Hopkins University. We're talking about mental health and college students. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And just by way of asking, has any of your students ever said, you know, I'm really offended that you're talking to me about this? This is my business. Leave me alone.
They teach you when you see the proverbial red flag, or you're particularly afraid of someone who's considering self-damaging behavior, to ask a person, "Have you ever considered suicide?" Because it's true that the suicidal person will usually tell you that they have, whereas the person who isn't genuinely suicidal will say no. You see all sorts of, I mean, there are all kinds of hints to it.
Let's get a caller in on the conversation. This is Matt, and Matt's calling us from Ames in Iowa.
Yes. I wanted to comment on, I think that the issue of privacy would be much less important if we were able to eliminate much of the stigma that surrounds mental illness. If people felt more comfortable in getting help and telling their friends that they need help and teachers, I think that it would be less of an issue for outside parties to intervene if the student felt that they would be cared for as a capable person that has a health problem that is oftentimes like any other.
And do you speak from personal experience here, Matt?
I do, and fortunately, I haven't personally been surrounded so much with many of the problems associated with the stigma surrounding mental illness, but I know a lot of people that have been in my life that needed help and for one reason or another didn't seek help. They thought it was for somebody that was much worse off than they were. And the fact is, if mental illness is interfering in your life, it's worthwhile to seek help for it like you would anything else.
And in the cases of those friends that you're talking about who you thought needed help, would you have thought it appropriate for you to mention that to officials at the school, to their parents?
Well, in one case, I mentioned it to a parent, and unfortunately, the parent felt much the same way that my friend did as well. It's something that I think a lot of people just feel is somebody else's problem and not theirs. And I think part of the issue is that even with the Virginia Tech massacre, even though it was a horrible thing that happened, this was clearly a sick person that could have received help. This isn't a person that was just plain a monster. And I think when we demonize people like that with mental illness, we're just encouraging more of those events to occur.
I was just going to say, I think you may be right, we demonize mental illness, but not necessarily the people. But go ahead.
Well, sure. But I think that what happens is that there are people that, one day could be receiving treatment and the next day do something that's very, very terrible. And I have another friend that actually did something. And I wish that I would have been able to help him with that issue earlier on. But again, there's a lot of people that don't want to address those problems. And even with professors, even with people that I've talked to myself as someone who suffers from depression, there are a lot of professors that want to be understanding, but it's difficult for them to know when someone is using mental illness as an excuse. So even those who try to be really understanding have trouble finding a spot where they can really intervene and really take care of that student.
Matt, thanks very much for the call.
Yes, thank
and
you.
Good luck to you. And we just have a few seconds left, Tristan Davis, but I wondered if you, the regret in Matt's voice was interesting.
Well, it's an extraordinarily difficult topic. I mean, it's a difficult subject, and it isn't just that. And I did a terrible job of answering your last question. I don't know. No, I've never had somebody be upset, because I think you ask somebody, "Are you feeling badly? Is everything okay? How are things going?" I don't think anybody's ever offended by polite inquiries of care. The problem is that mental illness is extraordinarily difficult. It's a very, very serious condition, and the first step to dealing with it is being aware of it and being educated about it.
Tristan Davis, thanks very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Neil.
Tristan Davis, a senior lecturer in the writing seminars at Johns Hopkins University. He joined us from member station WYPR in Baltimore. Coming up, we'll talk about Cornell's campus mental health system and how they navigate the tricky intersection between privacy and a parent's right to know. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. After the mass shooting a year ago at Virginia Tech, campuses got tough on reporting concerns about the mental health of their students. A program at Cornell University enlists everybody from resident advisors to custodial staff to keep an eye out and report emotional problems in their students. Our guest now is Gregory Eales. He's Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at Cornell. And we also want to hear from you, of course. If you're a student, professor, counselor, or administrator, how does your school address mental health on campus? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Gregory Eales, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks, Neil. Good to be here.
Gregory Eales with us from members Mississippi Public Broadcasting in Jackson, Mississippi, where he's on vacation, I should point out. Professors aren't the only ones responsible for the warning signs. We were talking, I think you heard part of our conversation with Tristan Davis at Johns Hopkins a moment ago.
Yes.
And the fact is, there are others who on campus who may see more of or perhaps different sides of students than professors.
Oh, that's right. And one of the things we've tried to do is educate people on doing the things that Tristan just talked about. Noticing the symptoms, noticing the signs, knowing how to get help, knowing how to direct people how to get help. We've developed some programs that really focus on educating faculty, educating staff, educating advising staff, even educating residential staff, including some of the janitors, which was a story featured in the Wall Street Journal.
Mm-hmm.
So we've really tried to take a very comprehensive campus approach.
In the Wall Street Journal story, one of the custodial staff noticed, one of the students vomiting a lot and was concerned about the possibility of an eating disorder.
That's correct, and was able to get that student connected with appropriate resources. I mean, that's the goal that we try to bring about is with our counseling services, connecting people to care, and that's our goal within the whole health service and taking a very comprehensive approach that involves education. Other things we do with our health services, screen for depression, connect with the counseling service. So a lot of our efforts are really about trying to connect people with care, because when people do get care, they generally get better with medication, with counseling.
And a couple of concerns that I know people will ask about, one of which is, are students aware that this large group of people who they are in and among every single day are monitoring them effectively and for mental health problems and meeting to share information about them?
Well, and I wouldn't say it so much as monitoring. I like the way that Tristan talked about it. It really is caring. It's a way to notice someone that you care about if they're struggling, if they're experiencing difficulties. Our goal at Cornell, and I think many universities, is to create caring communities where people across the campus aren't monitoring per se, but are really noticing because they genuinely care about the students that they're dedicating their lives to serve. And I think I know a lot of faculty, a lot of support staff, a lot of counseling center staff, and janitors feel the same way. Mm-hmm. So hopefully it's not perceived as monitoring. And even noticing each other as students, I think, is a piece that we try to talk to many of our students who are peer educators about, that it really comes from a place, hopefully, of genuine caring across the entire university community.
And these are adults, young adults for sure, but nevertheless,
sure.
Adults, aren't they responsible for themselves?
Well, yes. I mean, one of the things with medical care, counseling care, it is founded on the principle of autonomy. So people do have the right to say, I don't want care, to leave from a hospital, AMA, those sort of things. But there's a fine line. I think a lot of times when people are experiencing a mental health difficulty, whether it's an eating disorder, depression, anxiety, it's someone's own mind turning against them, turning against their experience. So a lot of times what's needed is a caring community that provides support and helps direct people and helps them kind of respond to their better judgment.
And one other criticism I've heard about is that there is so much concern about critical cases and so much attention that people who are merely stressed out have a hard time accessing the same kind of resources.
Yeah, and I think it's a continuum. I mean, the reality is it's not that someone just wakes up and then they're very dangerous to themselves or somebody else, that it's a continuum of suffering and pain, and hopefully, like some of the things we try to do is take a public health approach that you reach people before it gets to that critical point through a connection with faculty or staff or other students, that if you can connect before it gets to that critical point and something awful happens, hopefully you can prevent that. I mean, that's the general public health philosophy that we've tried to embody through many of our efforts.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is John, and John with us from Oxford, Illinois.
Hello, Neil.
Hi.
I was calling to talk about an experience I had in high school when an instructor was actually generating a discussion group, and the topic was suicide, and I very rationally took the approach that if you're going to do it, you know, there are more and less certain ways to do it. And that landed me a mandated meeting with a psychiatrist weekly for 2 months. And if anything, that has made me more resistant and more wary about seeking out any assistance, because my mental state was not taken into account and no further investigation was done.
I'm unclear. Did you think this was an overreaction or an underreaction?
Absolutely an overreaction, and I feel like the resources that were given me could have been used better for someone else.
Do you understand the idea that, well, better safe than sorry?
Better safe than sorry, but to not take any other mitigating information into account and, like I said, to spend 2 months' worth of resources not consulting my parents at the time, I think was wasteful.
John, thanks very much. Appreciate it. And I wonder, Gregory Eales, have you encountered any similar kinds of situations?
Well, I think what the caller was talking about is there is, if people are feeling like they're forced into treatment or forced into care, or it's not really perceived as caring, clearly from his response, it didn't feel like there was a caring response from his high school. So I think that a key piece that needs to be thought about is how do you meet people where they are? How do you really find out what's really going on with them? Because it sounds like in his case, he wasn't suicidal. It sounded like more of a philosophical discussion. I think many of the things that we need to be aware of in response to Virginia Tech is not overreacting. I mean, we don't want colleges to be these closed-down places where people are monitoring somebody all the time. We want them to be caring communities where there is a safety net. If people's judgment is compromised, if there's some kind of impulsive act or suicidality that's present, that there is hopefully a safety net that connects the person before something like it happens. So I think we really need to fight against that perception that it's mandated or that it's something that has to happen when that may not be the case, as in the caller's story.
Kate's with us. Kate is calling us from Greensboro, North Carolina.
Hi. My comment was about continued monitoring of students who have already diagnosed mental illnesses. I was diagnosed with depression, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and social anxiety disorder in high school, and went off to school from North Carolina to Minnesota, and did some counseling. There was a counseling service on campus, very good. Did some counseling my freshman year. The summer after my freshman year, I started a new medication, and then about 3 weeks after starting the medication, went back to school for my fall semester. Had a very bad reaction to the medication and ended up attempting suicide. And I feel like if there had been continued monitoring, you know, if my doctor had gotten in touch with one of the counselors at the school and continued monitoring how the medication treatment was going, it could have been prevented.
And how are you doing now, Kate?
I'm doing great. I'm on a great medication. I've been through therapy. I'm now, I've obviously taken some time off from school, finished graduating here at UNC Greensboro, and doing very well.
Well, well, thank heavens for that, and congratulations.
But can I respond to that, Neil?
Yes, please. I was just going to ask you to.
Well, I think that's a great story, and I think one of the issues that we try to work on is coordinated care. I mean, a lot of times if people are on medication, they may be getting medication from a physician who may not be in touch with the counseling service at the university, and I think it's an issue of resources and available psychiatry oftentimes at universities where, you know, at Cornell, we have psychiatrists in our center that work closely with the therapists, continue people on their medication throughout the summer. Hopefully they can reengage in treatment. And obviously that's not a panacea to mean that nothing bad's ever going to happen. But I think it helps at least facilitate the likelihood that the care is going to be coordinated and that's going to continue throughout a summer or breaks. Mm-hmm. Because it's one of the difficulties in treating college students is that there are these breaks in the summer, there are breaks around the holidays and other times when people go to spring break and so forth, that sometimes maintaining care and keeping connected with them is a challenge that is a little more challenging than some other environments.
Kate's call also illustrates another aspect of the situation, and that is that because of improvements in treatment and medication and mm-hmm. that sort of thing, a higher number of children, kids, who have mental problems are going on to college and university.
Yeah,
that's right. And that's one of the things that we try to do is we ask students when they come to Cornell, is we have fill out a health history form. We ask them, you know, to voluntarily give us information. It's not related to admissions, but it's really related to, you know, if you have these concerns and you've had this dream in the past, would you like to transfer your care to us? Would you like to continue with your medications? This is how you do that, how you get connected.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you're right. Many people are coming because of better treatments that 15 or 20 years ago maybe wouldn't have been able to go to college.
Kate, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much. I'm glad y'all are doing this story today.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Here's an email from James in Denver, Colorado. At about the same time as the Virginia Tech incident happened, I was on an honors program in D.C. through the University of Texas system. Rather than help me with my concerns and issues, they excused me from the program, disinvited me from all events, isolated me from other students in the program. The coordinator's answer, rather than to refer me to some sort of assistance, was to pray for me. Only one of the professors, a professor from Johns Hopkins, actually took an interest in me personally and keeping in touch with me to make sure I was all right. I hope this is the exception and not the rule at universities, but I fear after events like VaTech, people like me are more and more isolated. Do you think that's the result of an incident like VaTech, that people are more isolated?
Well, I hope not. I mean, like I was saying before, hopefully what colleges and universities are doing, the better way to respond is to look at ways you can reduce the risk of these things happening by keeping students connected. Now, obviously, the person who emailed in felt the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And I think that, like I was saying before, too, is the risk is we don't want to be punitive. What I think we're trying to do at Cornell and many universities is create this network where it is perceived as caring, where it's not punitive, but there are ways to connect. There's ways to get connected in the available resources. Now, when you talk about study abroad programs, I think sometimes those feel kind of scary for universities because the student is away. It's harder to provide them the network of care. But still, a punitive response is generally not going to be one that's perceived as very helpful, especially if it's isolating.
Let's go to Kevin. Kevin with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm very well, thank you.
I actually went to Ithaca College in Ithaca, right next to Cornell.
Yeah.
And I had grown up overseas, and when I came back to Ithaca, you know, they had all these programs that were supposed to sort of be very diverse and promote diversity, and I found myself being even more isolated. I'd broken up with a girlfriend, and I called one of my friends from Singapore to kind of, you know, cry to. I was definitely very sad, and I told her at the end of the conversation, I said, you know, sometimes I just feel like going to sleep and dying, curling up into a ball and dying. And she says, you know, Kevin, are you okay? And I said, no, I'm fine. You know, I'm just a little depressed. She's like, are you sure you're not going to kill yourself? Because you said that you felt like dying. I said, no, I'm sure. She kept pushing the issue. I kept saying I was okay, and eventually I hung up the phone, at which point she called the police. The police came to my door. They brought me to the medical center on campus at about 3 in the morning. Now, this was the second day of classes, so I was going to have the first day of some classes the next day. They had me talk to psychiatrist on the phone. I told my story once. She seemed like she didn't listen. She asked me to repeat it. It felt like she was actually asleep. Finally, I just said, look, I'm okay. I need to go back to school or to sleep so I can get to school in the morning. I hung up on her, and the cops took me into Cayuga Medical Center. When I was down there, they asked me what my plan upon release would be. I was checked out by a social worker at night. Social worker said I was fine. Then they said, but, you know, you have to see the doctor tomorrow morning, so we're going to keep you overnight. The doctor asked what my plans were when I left. I told the doctor, you know, well, I need to figure out why I stayed here. Well, the school's policy is to keep you overnight if you're, you know, suicidal. I said, but I'm not. And he's like, well, what are you going to do if you leave? And I said, well, I don't know why the school, you know, was going to keep me overnight. They didn't even have a doctor come in and look at me. So, you know, pretty much I'm going to probably go to my grandparents' house and think about withdrawing from Ithaca College. The doctor said, that's not a rational decision. You're not thinking rationally. We're going to keep you another night. At which point, you know, my parents were calling. They were living in Tokyo at the time. They were really upset. My mom was, you know, thinking that I was going to kill myself because that's all that she had heard. You know, I got calls from my best friends. The only call that I got that was constructive to me was my brother saying, how do you get yourself into these situations? You know, I know you're not going to kill yourself. You know you're not going to kill yourself. Why are you there a second night? Well, after all was said and done, I got really annoyed. But, you know, when I went home, I just said, okay, you know, I'm going to forget about it. Next year I'm going to try and transfer out somewhere. And then I received a bill in the mail for $1,200 for services that I didn't even want.
Stay with us a moment, Kevin.
Okay.
We're talking about mental health and college students. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Any response to that, Gregory Eales? I mean, again, it sounds like overreaction. Again, safer than sorry, but still.
Yeah, it was obviously an awful experience for our caller. And I think one of the things it illustrates is it is a very challenging thing from a mental health perspective to assess suicide well. And if you go to a training on suicide assessment, which not all mental health professionals do, but hopefully would, and one of the first things they get you to look at is look at your own reactions as a therapist or mental health professional to people talking about suicide and talking about, you know, sometimes just depression and pain and wanting to escape that pain, which is a fairly normal part of human experience. So, but many times it elicits fear among mental health professionals. So, you know, one of just a general response, I think, is his call illustrates how sometimes that can be problematic. And I think all of us in the mental health field need to be trained to respond as appropriately as possible because we're trying to balance the, I think, the ethical dilemma of how do you care for somebody who sometimes, because of their illness, can't make good decisions about themselves with the fact that, you know, people are still oftentimes rational and autonomous and you want to support them and really find out what's going on with them. So, I mean, obviously can't speak specifically to this case, but those were a few of the reactions I had listening to his story.
Kevin, good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Jeff in Illinois. I ran the juvenile section of the Oak Park, Illinois Police Department for 9 years and thus had a profound interest in whether it could be predicted whether a particular young person was likely to commit suicide or homicide. At that time, the social workers and psychologists told me they had no instruments that would make such a prediction. So is the situation different today? Are there widely accepted standards for evaluating whether someone is likely to do harm to himself or others? Because if the answer is no, there's no reason to expect that present efforts, however sincere, can produce good results.
Well, I think, you know, there's no kind of magic pill that's going to predict with 100% accuracy. And we know that there are certain factors that increase people's likelihood. I mean, we do the best using the scientific tools that we have in terms of assessment to manage risk and figure out, does this person have these risk signs? Is it 100% predictive? No, it's not. I think it's part of, like any science, we're continuing to learn how people respond. And I think it's always going to be challenging to predict 100% with 100% accuracy human behavior ever. Whether that's violence to self or violence to others.
Thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Gregory Eales is Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at Cornell University and Associate Director of the Gannett Health Services at Cornell. And he joined us today where he's on vacation at Mississippi Public Broadcasting in Jackson, Mississippi. And thanks to all the callers and emailers who shared their stories with us. And I'm just sorry we couldn't get more of them on the air. Stay with us, though. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with Morgan Spurlock about his new movie, Where in the World is Osama Bin Laden? I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.